Mixed Media Talks, a forum for artists to talk shop with each other and go deep into the intersections between a wide variety of different media forms, process, philosophy, all things that touch art in our lives. Hope to have a little fun with our guests, getting to nerd out while we do it. I'm your host, Amelia Hogan, a mixed media artist, singer, painter, book artist, and I have a deep love of all things art. Today's guest is Miss Postmortem, who does mortuary art.
Yes.
And cake baking. Those are not related necessarily. Makeup, theatrical performance, stage setting, costumey kinds of. You do sort of elaborate.
Mostly headdresses and special effects makeup, stage makeup. I also do restorative art to accident victims for their viewings. And, of course, the embalming itself is not only a science, it is an art as well. And it's a different canvas than what a regular makeup artist would be working on.
So you're a licensed embalmer.
Yes.
And one of the things that you had said, which is deeply intriguing to me, is art and science often have a connection in this world.
Yes.
In particular, the baking aspect also seems to carry that thread, that connection through what it is you're doing.
Yes, because you have chemistry, which makes the structure for your cake. And then the rest of it is applying those items to make art, the visual. But embalming is also, funny enough, similar because it is chemistry.
Yeah.
There's a lot of chemistry going on. There's also a lot of symmetry and coloration, hues, things that you depth. Have to take into consideration.
Sculptural stuff, depth.
Sculptural stuff. It's not just makeup. There's so many different facets that people don't realize. The finished product that you see in the casket is actually quite a few hours of work and is nothing like what the person looked like when they first come to us. Mm-hmm. And when people decide to view, that is the most important thing, is how their loved one looks. They're not going to remember the sermon. They're not going to remember what they wore, but they're going to remember how their loved one looked.
Yeah.
And that's why it's so important.
I love that you do this because I feel like this world lacks an awful lot of care and attention and focus to bodies as physical shapes and entities, and that all of that symbolism and meaning are wrapped up in these final moments of being in contact with this person that once was.
Yes.
Is there a moment in your process with this, with understanding how to do this and why to do this, that changed for you? Has there been a revelatory experience in which you fundamentally shifted a perspective around it?
One of the things that always stuck in my head as a kid is when I received photos from my grandfather's funeral. Mm. I was too young and we couldn't afford to fly back home. So my grandmother sent us photos. And my grandfather, who was a steel worker, volunteer firefighter, was in the Navy, cowboy, he had this pale makeup and red lips and these huge pink circles on his cheeks. And he looked absolutely terrible. And all I can think of looking at these pictures of my grandfather was a cross between John Wayne and Dirty Harry. And all I can think of is my grandfather, if he would have sat up in that casket and punched the embalmer in the face for doing that to him. I thought it was just such a dishonor to him to make him look like that.
Yeah. To not acknowledge the life he actually lived.
And also just clearly showed that this person did not have an understanding of how people look. You don't do that kind of makeup. Makeup is not synonymous between male and female, and even in between races. It's different for each race, each sex, each culture. Felt it was such a disrespect, and that's all I can remember is how horrible he looked. And so when I did finally decide to go into mortuary science, one of the things that I vowed is that I would never make someone look like a clown. look like. I do not ever want any of my clients to walk away saying, oh my God, can you believe how terrible they looked? I mean, I know how upset I was. And the thing, my part of my job is to give them a last memory of that person. Not sick in bed, not on hospital machines, you know, not looking disheveled and pale and ill, but to give them this peaceful, restful, serene last memory right. of them. And
that seems like a very, an so act important. Of love.
It is.
Is there a place in the world that you draw some of your favorite funerary traditions or ways of working with the body as an art form? Are there some just really beautiful cultural spaces that you pull from?
As far as embalming and makeup, not necessarily, but as far as in funeral customs, I absolutely adore some of the traditional Asian funeral customs. They're involved where it involves the family, each family member, and there's symbolism and art and meaning to every single thing that they do during the ceremony. And part of my job is to set up the funeral for that ceremony, whether it is a very traditional Japanese service where we dress the person in layers of clothing, and each layer is a different color and represents a different stage in life. And then you cuff the sleeve so each color shows. Or in some cultures, they don't do that. They do the blankets. So each blanket that's laid down on the person is a certain color. And I arrange them in a way that when each family member comes up, they each pull up a blanket and it leaves this stripe of colors representing their stages in life, depending on how old they were. And then there's all the things that they put inside the casket with them, traveling clothing. So a lot of times they just bring me the clothing. I separate it into little outfits. These pants go with this shirt and these socks and these shoes. And I set up all these little outfits and I place them in the foot of their casket because that's all the clothing they're going to need for their afterlife. They have a party dress, they have a swimsuit, they have pajamas, they have winter clothing. I mean, it's just like such a...
Uncle Knick-Knack's summer wardrobe. Uncle Knick-Knack's winter wardrobe. Uncle Knick-Knack.
It's so much, there's so much meaning in all those things I do. And then there's some of them have like the hell notes and then paper money and things like that. Others do these paper lotus flowers that we place certain colors in certain places around the body. I mean, just all these different things. And they're all so meaningful. I think it's just absolutely beautiful.
What's one of the most challenging funerary customs or practices that you've encountered in terms of...
I would say as a woman, it would have to be when we have some of the Buddhist monks. I mean, they're not allowed to be within a certain space of me. They can't share... Like, they can't be in the same car with me. So it's difficult because if I'm the embalmer and I'm the person who is in charge or the funeral director, I want to be right there with them, but I also have to keep my distance. So I have to remember that and not reach out and put my hand on their shoulder as in comfort and things like that. So that I find that difficult because I can not only just care about the person who's taking care of, but I care about the family. So sometimes you come up to people and you might touch them on the shoulder or come up to them and talk to them. But I have to keep my distance in some cultures between male and female. I can find that difficult, but I completely respect it. But it can be difficult because I have to totally switch gears and be a little bit more distant with them where I'm a very involved person when it comes to my families. I don't want to just know, what do you want to do for your family member? I want to know, one of the first things I ask my families when they come in, how are you holding up? Do you have any questions? What can I do for you? Before we start making any kind of arrangements, I want to know how they're holding up, how they're feeling. Because that lets me know what I need to do for them. Do I need to comfort them? Do I need to reassure them? Are they nervous? Or have they ever done this before?
Have they had a terrible experience? You and I have talked a couple of times about that. One chaplain at the hospital.
Oh, goodness, yes. No, don't worry, he's not there anymore. He hasn't been there
for listeners, this person was pretty awful when my father died, and he leaned in and his eyes got all big and he got all excited. And we were watching him listen to us, my brothers and I, and my mom and everybody sobbing and telling our stories and having our moment with our father passing. And he's leaning in and getting all excited. And by excited, I mean, he got a Woody. It was bad. He was into it in a really disrespectful, horrible way. And that stuck with me, that within minutes of seeing my father's now dead body, and this guy who's supposed to be comforting and helping us through this is not.
Chaplain creepy.
Not so good.
No.
Are there funny stories? Is there anything that's just like, oh my God, this one thing was hysterical
that you're allowed to tell? Yes. Like, I absolutely love it when families just start talking about their loved ones, start sharing stories. And a lot of people think that grieving is only sadness. But grieving is not just sadness, it's also remembrance. So remembering the good times and remembering funny stories and laughing is completely normal. And it's okay. People sometimes feel bad for laughing. And it's like, no, you're remembering. That's what your loved one will want you to do. They want you to remember the good times. And I love it when families share stories. And I mean, I'm cracking up right along with them. I think one of the most memorable funny things that ever happened, it was kind of a multiple fold thing. He was a Japanese gentleman. I was an apprentice. He was a Japanese gentleman. He was a character actor in movies since he was very young, all the way up to his old age. And the first funny thing that happened is I did his makeup and everything, very natural, like I always do for men. And the family's like, no, can you do more? More? They're like, yeah, like opaque, like more. He was an actor. So he, growing up, they always saw him in camera and stage makeup, almost always, because he acted up until he was like 60s. They're like, no, more makeup. Okay, not what I usually do. So I put on some little bit heavier makeup. No, more. More. Yeah, more. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, I'm going to make this guy look like a porcelain doll. So I did more. And he looked like a porcelain doll. And they were like, oh, that's perfect. That's how we remember him. And I'm like, okay. And normally, this is what I try to avoid when doing makeup on men. But they really wanted it. Then it comes time to go to the cemetery.
Oh dear.
And the hearse door where you unload the casket breaks and I cannot get it open. So I crawl into the back of the hearse, push the casket to the side. I'm squeezing my body in between the casket and the inside of the hearse to get to the inside door to try to figure out how to get the door open from the side.
Oh no.
I couldn't get it open. It was broken.
That's fun.
It was not coming open. There's only one way to get the hearse in and out of the casket in and out of the hearse. I had to tell the family, I'm really sorry, but we're going to have to take the hearse to our mechanic to have him take off the door to get your dad's casket out so we can inter him. And the family's like, okay, we're just going to go ahead and go to the reception and then we'll come back. Luckily, it was the only burial of the day, so the cemetery was fine with it. And we come back. And of course, I had to use one of the utility vehicles instead of the hearse because they had to take the door off, get back. And I'm like literally just about in tears and I'm apologizing to this family and I'm bowing to them. I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry. And they go, no, that was so dad. Dad, he was a prankster. That was his last joke on us. That was perfect. And they just started laughing. And then I started laughing and also still wanting to cry. But oh my God, I was, best word, mortified. I was mortified. It all ended up turning out okay.
Yeah.
But it could have gone really bad, too.
Oh my God. That is awesome. I'm like,
I could have ruined this family's memory of their dad, and instead it just enhanced it. That's like one of my favorite funny moments that has ever happened in a funeral.
Oh my gosh, that's so fun. Maybe let's start at a beginning for you. How did you get into it?
My mother was a paramedic. I used to, as a little girl.
So you were an ambulance. No. This is kind of the opposite of that.
My mother always had her trauma books, her training books at home. And when I was little, I would look through the books. And I would be like, look, mommy, this boy's eyeball is hanging out. And she's like, yes, honey, and this is how we fix it. And none of this stuff ever bothered me. She let me look at her anatomy books and all that. And I was totally cool with it. No nightmares or anything like that. Just a natural morbid curiosity as a kid. So I wanted to go into forensic pathology. But then I was looking at 15 years of medical school and continuing education. And being from a poor family, I was like, there's no way I can afford this.
Yeah.
So I did an apprenticeship, or kind of a day apprenticeship, through the high school with the coroner. And I got to hang out with the coroner. coroner for a day, and I got to see autopsies, we got to look over cold case files and things like that. And out of the group of six of us, only two of us were still interested at the end of the day of still wanting to go into pathology. I said, okay, say if somebody can't become a forensic pathologist, what do you do? They said, well, 2 years of mortuary science or 2 years of nursing. Well, the nursing program had a 6-year waiting list, and when I found out during orientation that they practice threading IV needles on each other, I was like, nope, nope. I cannot handle living pain, living human blood, living trauma like that. I just can't do it. But the dead don't feel anything. I'm okay with that. Right. So I went into mortuary science, thinking it was going to be a stepping stone into the coroner's office. But once I got into the business, figured I can use so many of my talents and really help people and really touch people's lives rather than just being in a lab, I decided to say I have more of an impact than just pushing papers and looking through a microscope. Not that I don't appreciate everything that the forensic guys do. I love them. I just want to be more. I want to do more.
But it sounds like it's more of a specifically a service place. Like it's in service to people and humans. Mm-hmm. And that's where the art comes in, is the connection to how people feel, right? Mm-hmm. Like the work that you're doing as an artist in touch with people's most vulnerable stuff around their own mortality. Mm-hmm. That's where it gets interesting.
Yes. I don't think everybody who goes into the industry or who are embalmers, not everybody necessarily feels that way, or they feel it to a certain degree. For me, it's almost spiritual, and it's not just a job or a paycheck, but an actual calling. Like, I take it very seriously, and even though we all crack jokes, you know, that's every industry. Everybody cracks jokes, but I do take it very seriously, and I actually feel like whenever I take care of somebody, I invest part of myself into that family and into that person. I take this personal responsibility and care for them.
I think you'd have to if you are treating it like an art form that has the capacity to impact the people for whom it exists.
And it's not just for the living. People say, oh, funerals are just for the living. I'm the type of person who thinks, some people say, oh, it's just a shell. No, for me, that person is still lingering. They're still there a little bit.
Like related to that body.
Yes, because you haven't quite given them the send-off yet sometimes. Mm. And sometimes I feel like they linger. They have to say goodbye in a way. And the funerals, I know it sounds cornier, but I still feel like sometimes, there's especially some people, I feel like they're kind of lingering around a little bit.
Yeah.
And then when we do the ceremony or the burial or something, it's like they can kind of move on a little bit. But I feel like I'm doing it for them as well. It's like my grandmother would have been mortified if her hair and makeup wasn't done right.
Sure.
You know, and
mortified.
She would have been. I love that word, mortified, because she would have been. My grandmother always looked, even when she's going to the grocery store, she always looked like her best. And so I flew out to Michigan and I did her hair and makeup and nails and everything, got her ready, and she looked perfect. And I'm not just saying that and tooting my own horn. All my family was like, oh my gosh, it looks like her, because they remember how my grandfather looked.
Yeah, know? I mean, that's a sharp contrast, right?
Yeah, I invest part of myself into each person, not only the family, but the body themselves. To me, it's not just a shell. It's a person. It's still a person. And I want to do right by them.
So talk to me about maybe your definition of art. And has your work in funerary arts had an impact on some of the other kinds of art you do and have done, and vice versa?
I think it's being in the funeral industry has definitely changed some of my perspectives on life, how we live. But I think everything I've done up to point, and it's still a continuing education kind of thing, has led up to this. Because I worked for Lancome Paris, and I did makeup then. I did stage makeup in high school. I've always done costuming and stuff, and I feel like everything just kind of came together. And I can use all of these things to do this work. It's definitely changed my perspective on life, and the importance of saying goodbye, and the importance of viewing, and the importance of those who want to view, how impactful it is. And that the tiniest, tiniest detail can make or break their perception. For instance, I know this is going to sound funny, we all have a little bit of hair on our lip. Mm-hmm. Men, women. When women get older, they go through menopause there, and sometimes the hair gets a little bit thicker.
Sure.
Most people aren't going to notice grandma's Fu Manchu, because when they are talking to grandma, they're engaging with grandma. They're talking to her. They're not talking to a mustache. They're talking to grandma. They're talking to the person, the spirit of that person, the personality. They're engaged with the person's eyes and their voice. But when they're laying in the casket, you don't have all of that interaction. You don't have the voice and the eyes and the laughter. So they focus on the face because a lot of people are expecting them to open their eyes and go, "Hi, how you doing?" Or, "Hey, honey." And they're so focused on the face that all of a sudden they realize Grandma has a mustache that they never noticed before, because you don't see the birthmark or the scar or the mustache. You see the person that is in front of you, the person. Like, I don't notice my mother's burn scars. I mean, she brings them up and I'm like, because I see her, not her physical her, I see her. And so they're so focused that they'll notice details like that. And then they're like, "Well, why didn't they shave off Grandma's mustache?" So, you know, so I pay attention to details like that.
And you get to be objective about this person's.
The only time I don't shave mustaches is with Russian Orthodox, Jewish Orthodox, and there's usually like elder, like Indian. Not Native American, but India. You don't shave the mustache because it's almost like a status. It's almost like, you know, this is a sign of their age and wisdom.
Sure.
There's certain cultures you don't do that. But mostly everybody, just about everybody gets shaved. It also helps with the makeup.
Speaking to my own lack of awareness in this, talk to me about the myth of your hair and fingernails still grow when you're dead. Isn't it like the tissue shrinks back?
It's just dehydration. Your cuticles dehydrate, your scalp, your skin and your scalp dehydrates, and it pulls away, so it does make this appearance. I mean, it's very minor, unless you're talking about somebody who's dug up years later and they're mummified. Yeah, it's going to look like, because of all the dehydration. No, they don't grow. Everything, the only thing that would still grow after death is bacteria.
Fun.
It's true. But yeah, so like little details like that. And speaking of fingernails, I don't know how many times I have gone in to do makeup or something for another embalmer, and the fingernails are filthy, or they're ragged, or the cuticles are all, because sometimes people are in nursing homes, they don't get to bathe regularly. It's just sponge baths, and they got cradle cap between their fingers where the skin is just, I mean, there's two things that you see when you're viewing. You see the face, and you see the hands. A person who, one of the first things I do is I soak the hands with, believe it or not, it's just clarifying shampoo. And I let it set, wrap a warm, wet washcloth around their hands. And then I go with like a scrub brush and I scrub the cuticles and I clean underneath the nails and I trim them and I shape them. Because nobody wants to see like grandpa's overgrown raggedy nails from him being in bedridden for a year in the nursing home. It's gross. And then they're going to remember that. They're not going to remember how grandpa looked peaceful. They're going, "Oh God, did you see grandpa's hands? Ugh."
Yeah.
When was the last time they cut his nails? However, I will not do feet. People have asked me to do pedicures. I'm like, mm-mm. You're not going to see the feet? Nope. I am not doing pedicure.
That is not how that do.
Yeah, the tiniest little details can make or break something.
Yeah. Talk to me about ethics and funerary art. Place where you had to be staunch in your ethics. Ethical considerations.
In a lot of the Asian cultures, you do not cut the clothing up the back, which is a standard practice when dressing someone, especially when they're heavy or the clothing is too small. Standard practice is to cut like shirts and jackets and stuff up the back, or dresses up the back. Easier to dress the deceased. You cannot do that in most Asian cultures because that's going to be how they're going to walk around in the afterlife. So they don't want their loved one walking around with their bottom hanging out. For all afterlife, you know? So there's certain cultures where you do not cut the clothing. Also with bikers, if you have a biker, you do not cut their cut. That's their vest that they wear with all their patches. Never, ever cut a biker's cut. It is blasphemy. My stepfather, he was a biker, and helped dress him. And all the bikers would come up to the casket. I'd see them kind of like look around and then reach behind his head, behind his shoulder to check to make sure his cut had not been cut. Other ethical things that people ask me to do, and I absolutely will not do it. I will not remove dental gold.
Oh my God.
I will not remove dental gold.
It's so tawdry.
I know, but people either think we do it automatically, which I said, no, that is not something we do. I think it's kind of an urban legend, and also I think that a lot has to go back to the Holocaust.
Okay.
Where they were pulling the gold teeth from people who were sent to the camps and pulling them out of them while they were alive. To siphon the gold. So I think that's kind of one where that they think that we just do that. I've had people ask. I will not. I consider it mutilation. To tell you the truth, the process for siphoning the gold out of the amalgamation is going to cost you more than what the gold is actually worth. But I told people, absolutely not. I will not do it, because you can't just take the gold. You have to pop out the whole tooth. And I personally, ethically, morally think that is mutilation. And I absolutely will not do it. I will not remove skin for tattoos. People want, oh, I want to keep dad's tattoo. Mm-mm. Nope. I will not do it. Absolutely not. It's mutilation. So ethical things like that. What really breaks my heart is when somebody, male or female, that is their identity. I had one where makeup, hair, nails, everything.
You're talking trans woman.
Trans woman.
Okay.
And this is before trans rights
were more mainstream or more in the public eye.
And in the funeral industry, trans rights are actually now part of the death certificate process. We actually have things that they can't argue with us. This person identifies as female. We put that on the death certificate. So this is before we had all those rights. Family made, I might cry a little bit, sorry. The family made me take off her nails, bind her chest, remove her false eyelashes, cut her hair, dye it, and take away any trace of who she was, and maybe dress her in a suit. And I just cried and apologized to her the whole time, because I didn't have a choice at that time. I didn't have a choice. They were the parents, and they had the right to tell us how to do what to do. They had the right of disposition in accordance to California state law. And it broke my heart, and it was such a dishonor and disrespect to her that still to this day it bothers me. And I think of her, and I just hope that she forgives me for having to do that.
Grab you a tissue. Because you know your work, and you know the love that you put into honoring the dead, and you have been trained to do that honoring the dead, and when that doesn't match legal, worse yet, there are not legal protections.
I think that's probably one of the worst things I've had to do. I mean, I've done accident restorations, and people have jumped in front of trains and fallen out of buildings and been burned. And it's hard to restore those, but I'm also helping them and helping the family. Whereas that was...
That felt like desecration of the person in front of you.
Yeah, because it was... They wanted to see...
Their mental image of this person rather than...
And
who they actually were.
I mean, all the friends and everybody who came to the service were just like, that's not her. And it was just heartbreaking. And the parents, and the parents did do it in spite. And that is the hardest thing, you know. I think one of the hardest things I've had to do, besides having to walk somebody up to the casket to see their loved one, to hold them and guide them up to the casket to see their loved one, because they're especially unexpected death and they need somebody there to literally hold them up. I mean, I've held so many crying mothers and wives and widows and even some fathers I've had to hold. That's probably the second hardest thing to do, is especially hear a parent cry over their child's body. That's a sound you never forget, because that's not a sound you could possibly recreate. It is, I mean, it comes from so deep in the soul that I can't even describe what it sounds like. That's probably the second hardest thing to do with my job, is having to guide someone up to the casket just to see their loved one for the first time, you know.
Are there places where the law supports an unethical act where you have been able to buck that convention and then be proved right?
Yes. Yes, we do have a lot of ethics and moral laws. Mutilation is a big thing. So no unnecessary mutilation. Now, what I do is making an incision to raise an artery. It's called necessary mutilation.
Sure.
I need to do that in order to get the artery so I can embalm. Unnecessary mutilation would be like removing a tattoo, skin. Or I would have to say the weirdest thing I ever had someone request of me, and I was like, oh, hell no. I had a wife ask me to remove her husband's member and place it in a jar of formaldehyde so she could take it home.
So you're talking genitals.
Yes.
Wow. That's straight out of fiction.
It was totally surreal. And I was like, please tell me this is a joke, in my head. And the counselor was like, no, she's serious. I'm like, no. Ethically, no. No.
Oh my God.
That is some that request out of all the weird things that I've had, out of all the weird requests I've had, and some people think their requests are weird, but they're not. They're just like sentimental requests, like, hey, can we put a bag of weed and a bottle of Jack Daniels in with grandpa? Sure. I don't mind.
Make him a cocktail.
Yeah. Hey. But that, somebody asked me to remove. That takes the taco. Man, that takes the burrito. That takes the whole taco truck. I have yet to receive a request that tops that. That is definitely my number one WTF moment.
Maybe let's switch some gears. Is baking, with its own chemical precision and processes, is that something you do as escape?
Oh, it's definitely therapeutic.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Well, and it's also definitely another thing of care, because when I do these cakes and stuff, I don't do it just for anybody. I do these cakes and stuff for friends, because it takes a lot of work. And I put a lot of thought and effort into it, so I couldn't do that professionally. So if I ever make somebody a cake, they know I love them.
Yay! I'm clapping, because she has made me a cake for my birthday. Yay. It was still lovely and delicious, so.
But yeah, it's definitely an escape. The baking is therapeutic. The decorating of the cake is definitely therapeutic, and I feel like it's also kind of a gift to the person I'm making the cake for, whether it's a wedding cake or a birthday cake. You know, it's kind of like, I made this for you. It's so pretty. I love you.
I totally adore that. That's a way to carry that affection and that sweetness.
And it's art, edible art.
Are there people in any of your art forms that are inspirational to you, that inspire you?
Yes, actually. There's one gentleman, and I still talk to him occasionally. He used to be our chemical representative for Dodge, and then he started his own company in Canada called Eccles. I think he's still doing Eccles. He's also an embalmer who has gone to like the Philippines and other countries and helped them open mortuaries and mortuary colleges and taught them how to do this stuff. And I've done a couple of his seminars, and I absolutely adore the man. His name is Jeff Chancellor. He is like the coolest person I know in the industry. And when Jeff Chancellor comes into your prep room while you're embalming and says, hey, can I show you something? You're like, yes! Teach me, master. Master Yoda, teach me what you can do.
I totally love it.
It's like, I took his seminar on restoration for harvest cases. And for most people don't know this, when you donate your organs, first of all, viable organs such as heart, liver, kidney, less than 2% of people are viable donors, because you have to die of brain death, not cardiac death. But the rest of the things that you can donate are skin, long bone, arteries, tendons, corneas. Now, if somebody is young enough and they do what we call a full harvest, they take the long bone, the legs, arms, a lot of the bone. They're literally from ankle to the tips of their wrist. And then I have to rebuild the structure sometimes for the body so that we can have a open casket viewing. Mm. And there's not a lot to work with because they've taken the arteries too. So I took a seminar on how to do all that. And it has paid off, because several places that I've worked, nobody knew how to take care of a harvest case. And I did. And for me, that was so worth it, because I was able to give this family a chance to have a viewing and say goodbye to their loved one. Where before, if it was the other embalmers, they would have been like, closed casket, sorry. You know, I learned that from him. I learned so many different techniques from him, but he's definitely inspirational. I love that man to death. He's awesome.
I love how the sort of mortuary humor comes into a lot of your conversational pieces here. What can you say to me about some places you've bumped up against convention and forged new ways of doing things? Where has been a way you have positively affected the path for people coming behind you?
Kind of through trial and error. So when you're in mortuary college, you learn the basics. You start honing your skills during your apprenticeship. And as you go through the years, you develop your own techniques and figure out things. I feel like I have developed several techniques that I have taught to a couple other people, and I look forward to teaching apprentices someday, that I think improves the viewing experience, because it leaves the person looking a little bit more natural. For instance, some of the restorative techniques are still old school. They've been using the same techniques since the 1800s. Okay, so somebody's missing teeth or something in the mouth, or they don't have teeth. You know, you put this thing called a mouth former. It's like a little plastic piece. So sometimes you have to trim it. Unfortunately, the way it's shaped sometimes gives people what I call monkey mouth.
Oh, it's too
them,
big.
Gives them like almost like a muzzle. Even if you try to trim it, it still sometimes doesn't look natural, especially if the person still has some teeth
there.
So the way they teach you in mortuary college is to take cotton and fill in the mouth. Well, the problem with cotton is it's not very malleable.
Oh. Okay.
And the other problem is during the embalming process, if a body, I know it's gross, they purge, which means something comes out of the body and through the mouth, that cotton soaks it all up. And then you have to redo it, and that often can mess up what you've already done setting the features.
Got it.
So I started messing around with sculpting wax.
Oh, interesting.
Sculpting wax is a great way to fill in missing teeth or overbites or underbites and give a natural look to the mouth without all the messes that cotton or that plastic provides. Mm. And what's great is it's malleable even after you close the mouth. So I'm able to shape the mouth. I say, oh, okay, this lip is sticking out a little bit too far. I can actually mold it when the mouth is closed. And so I can make those adjustments during embalming without having to redo everything. And because the mouth is really important with viewing, this is where the art comes into play. Some embalmers are like, the eyes are closed, the mouth is closed. What more do you want? No, the mouth and eyes are expression. Even though the eyes are not open, there's still a lot of expression in the face. So the way the lips are set, the way the corners of the mouth are set, how you adjust the jowl. If somebody has lost a lot of weight and they get jowly, mm-hmm. You know, they get jowls, you could accidentally give them what I call frog mouth because the skin will fold down.
Oh, interesting.
How the lip is set. You don't want them looking like their lips are pursed, like they're about to scold you on something. You don't want them looking like they got a big, like, lower lip, like they just got punched in the face either. And same thing with the eyes. You don't want them to look like they're squinting or scowling or they smell like, remember one of the very first bodies ever did makeup on, mm-hmm. She looked like she smelled something really stinky, kind of stink face look. And unfortunately, because she was embalmed, it was stuck that way. And there was nothing I could do about it because I wasn't the embalmer and it was already set. So that's where part of the art comes in, is understanding the way the face lays, the way the face looks, how to position it. And with some cultures, especially like Buddhists, sometimes they like it if the little corners of the mouth are just turned up just a little bit, kind of giving them a little bit of a smile, mm-hmm. because it means that they're happy and they're at peace. Now, you wouldn't do that with most people, but that little smirk, sometimes you can do that with some. And then there's some people, you just set their features and they naturally have this little smile on their face. And you're like, hey,
cool,
that's good.
Good for you.
But you also don't want to look somebody to look like they're stern or frowning or, I mean, there's so much expression in the face even.
So there's a certain amount of sculpting.
Yeah, there's a certain amount of sculpting, and there's different ways, you know, to make that mouth. And also you don't want it to look sunken or no lips. Because mm-hmm. the lips sink in because of no teeth or something. There's all these things in that expression, and that you want them to look peaceful. You don't want them to look constipated. Very much part of the art of embalming is...
So in sculpting, like, for example, the mm-hmm. difference between fondant and flesh, what are some of the differences? Like, what is specific to working with the body as a medium?
The body is face and stuff. Well, before embalming, it can be a little bit like clay and has a little bit of malleability, but not always. It really, there's so many different factors. But actually, it's after embalming, the medium that you're working with, the canvas,
okay,
is more like leather.
Interesting.
Rather than putting makeup on skin. So I worked at Lancôme Paris. Me putting makeup on, say, a living person,
yeah,
is completely different than putting makeup on a deceased. Completely different. You need to know where the warm... That's why you get a photo. You need to know where the warm patches are in the face. You need to know where their dark patches are. Especially if you're doing restorative makeup. Because your skin is naturally darker around the eyes and around the mouth. You don't necessarily see it on a day-to-day basis. But when all the color is flushed out of the face, it looks very flat. So you've got to know where your skin tones are. Mm-hmm. And you, for instance. If okay. I were doing your makeup as an embalmer, you have the redness, the natural rosiness in your cheeks and on mm-hmm. the tip of your nose and on the tip of your chin. I would want to put a little bit of that color back into you. So there's two ways I can do that. There's one is I can put dye in the formaldehyde, and that sometimes will, you know, bring color to the
like
skin.
Like up from the under.
From underneath, from underneath. Yeah, okay. Through the chemical. That doesn't always come into the right parts of the face. Second way is I do it with cosmetics. Usually sure. just a little bit of blush. That's all. Sometimes all you need is a little bit of powder, a little bit of blush, and a little bit of eyeliner just to tint the eyelashes, and then you can make somebody look 10 times better with just that tiny bit. But if you don't, then they look pale and flushed and they look dead, as people would say.
How long does it take?
It really depends. So many contributing factors. If somebody has coronary artery disease, most likely I'm going to have to raise more than just the one vessel. So that could be. And then I have some where it's just like, you know, start injecting and 10 minutes later, they're embalmed. And then makeup. Sometimes makeup can take 5 minutes. Sometimes it can take an hour. It really depends. Restorative makeup obviously takes a lot longer. And that's right. Another one where you said art-wise, some of my techniques I've developed over the years is skin tone with opaque makeup when you're covering up bruises or really bad discoloration like jaundiced or where their skin, like especially with darker skin tone, where the skin reacts with the formaldehyde and turns gray. That's why we use dyes. But sometimes it still happens. So with opaque cosmetics, I've developed several techniques to get a more natural looking skin tone rather than just a flat painting.
Yeah.
Because your skin is not one color.
No, it's a series of different colors. I wish people knew that in terms of portraiture. It's a series of different
colors.
Also.
Yeah. It's a series of different colors. Like you have very, very pale freckles.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to try to, with the opaque makeup, some of that's going to get covered. So I would want to try to emulate some of that from a photograph.
You know, people do those as tattoos these days.
I know, isn't that crazy?
I thought that was so funny. I was made fun of.
Yeah, but if you could either go really good or go really, really bad. So my makeup techniques, I've passed on to several people. And whenever I have somebody in the prep room that doing makeup for the first time or a family's doing makeup, I kind of guide them through that. But especially like an apprentice or somebody who's new, it's like I like passing those techniques on because in the future when they are embalmers, use my techniques, which is just going to make it better for the family. So there's that art in that, and I develop my own techniques and strategies and coloration, way to do coloration, and that in and of itself is an art, and I look forward to passing that on.
What are some of the barriers to being able to learn these arts? I mean, I know you and I have talked over many years about some of the industry-specific conventions that are really frustrating.
Some of the makeup that's available, they still, like I said, some of the stuff is still the same stuff that they've used for decades, for over a century. It's frustrating to find better stuff that works. And when I go to horror movie conventions that are specifically focused on special effects makeup,
mm-hmm.
and makeup application, I actually, when I go there, I don't just do it because I love the horror movies and stuff. I do it, I'm in search of new product and materials to use on restoration. Wounds and stuff. We're still using wax and this oil-based makeup that doesn't dry. Problem is people want to touch.
And so smudges and...
Yeah, it doesn't dry. Just wipe it off. It doesn't dry and the wax doesn't firm up. So if somebody reaches over and they could easily put a big old dent.
Thumbprint.
Or a nail print or something in the makeup or smudge it and stuff. And then for me to try to fix that can just either make it look worse, or it's like trying to fix something like that in front of a chapel full of people. It was really nerve-wracking.
No one can see my face right now, but it was sort of horrified.
Yeah, but people want to touch.
Oh.
I understand, especially like parents and children, siblings. You want to be able to touch your loved one because it's part of the grieving experience of the surrealness of walking up to a casket and seeing someone. You want to reach out and touch because you're like, is this freaking real? Or is this really them? Is this a doll? I mean, I've heard it all. It's like, I've had people flat out tell me that's not my mother because it's so, their brain is in such shock that they cannot comprehend that the person
right.
laying in the casket is actually their loved one.
Yeah.
And of course, that kind of freaks me out when people say that because I'm like, oh my God, did I put the wrong body in the casket? Crap. But I didn't. I check. And double check for name tags, and because we give everybody two bracelets, ankle and wrist, has their name on it.
No confusing who's
yeah. So
for which event?
I mean, it's people want to touch.
You and I've talked a lot about one of the pitfalls about the industry is old guard mentalities about the way the business has to be run.
Oh goodness, yes.
Where do you see yourself conflicting or wanting to shape a different thing? And what is it now? And what do you want to shape it to be like in the future so that you can be a better artist with it?
There's so many, especially with ceremony. This is where we could really open it up. Our current generations and stuff are very much into personalization.
Sure.
Making something unique for that person and not just a ceremony that is done for every single person, the same words, the same sermon, the same prayer over and over and over again, regardless of who is laying in the casket. Very old, very traditional. I'm mainly talking about Anglo-Saxon funeral traditions.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, like they're often so cookie cutter and it's the same thing over and over and over. And it doesn't feel personal to the person that's laying in the casket.
Right.
It doesn't seem like it's about them. And more people are doing celebration of life rather than funeral. And I really want to encourage that. And I want to be able to offer more ways to personalize a funeral for someone, whether the body is there or not. Make the funeral more about the person and about their life and about their legacy and less about
ticking a box.
I don't know. Yeah. Less about let's recite this same old, same old. More options. More personalization. Let's make it more about the person.
I sort of joke occasionally with people I know and love about what I would like when I'm ready to go. And, you know, I laugh about some of the things. But realistically, my hopes are that people take a moment to enjoy what I left behind and the impact I had in funny ways. Mm-hmm. And so I had this sort of, I heard a comedian talking about dressing up as a Grim Reaper, waving at people who coughed during the funeral. He was hired by someone to do this. And I was like, I'm totally paying my brother to do this. This is so freaking, he would have so much fun of all the ways to involve my brother so that he didn't feel just like an awkward person getting condolences and sads to at least give him something, an outlet for tee hee hee, like a little bit of that irreverence that is real and that is a part of me. Because there's a difference between pompous and serious, and there are places for each, but pompous is not me. Mm-hmm. Or one of the other fun ideas that I saw was what they call a lifetime supply of pencils for people's cremains to go into the carbon, the graphite carbon.
Oh, really?
For pencils. And I was like, that is genius. My physical form could go into people's creations.
Especially artists, writers. That actually,
I was like, that is magic, right?
I mean, I really love the whole thing that you can put cremated remains in these fireworks and they can like do this big firework display. And
not in California, but
not in California, but other places. And they do it over a lake. So it's like, that's awesome. I love that.
No, I totally
go out with a bang, you know?
Sorry. As it were.
No, that's really interesting. I've heard of people putting that, mixing the ashes with tattoo ink and getting a tattoo.
Yeah.
And that's really more psychological. The ashes actually don't stay in the skin.
Yeah. from a practical perspective, that's fair.
But it is sterile. So if anybody's wondering, like, ew, no, it's ashes are totally sterile.
Mushroom suits is another one that I thought was kind of interesting.
Works if you are in a cemetery that is a green burial cemetery.
Right, because otherwise chemicals leach or something?
No, most of the cemeteries use burial vaults.
Oh.
And it's a cement box at the lid, and it's designed to keep the ground level. So the chances of that mushroom suit actually doing what it needs to do is pretty slim. So it'd have to be a cemetery that either doesn't use burial vaults, and doesn't mind having a big mushroom patch on a grave, or a true green cemetery.
Right.
Which, speaking of, there are only a couple green cemeteries in this area.
Oh, yeah.
And one's up in Mount Tamalpais, and I cannot believe how much they're charging for just a simple green burial plot, something like $20,000 or $30,000.
Ooh.
And then the ones that are on the top of the hill overlooking Mount Tamalpais in the Bay Area are like $100,000. I'm like, are you kidding me?
What surprises you that you wish people knew?
That we don't bring your loved one to the funeral home and automatically cremate them without any paperwork.
Oh.
I'm surprised how many people think we just pick them up and just cremate them, like, without paperwork or permission or anything like that. I've had people call me on the phone frantic, don't cremate my mom! Well, you have to come in first and sign paperwork. Oh, we do? Yeah. Or that embalming is actually temporary, and depending on how well the person embalms, and some things are out of our control, sometimes somebody just does not want to firm up, or the chemicals just aren't reacting properly with their body for some reason.
Yeah.
Embalming is temporary, and it is temporary for viewing purposes. It's not going to permanently preserve this person in this perfect form forever.
Yeah. Not like a Twinkie.
I am never going to look at Twinkies the same way again. No, I'm just kidding. Actually, I'm the type of person, you can talk to me all about shop and surgeries and everything and make food references, and I'm still going to keep eating. Doesn't bother me.
For reference, I made cookies for the conversation.
Yeah, that embalming is not permanent. And embalming has varying different results. And after, if we do not get to embalming within a certain number of days, we may not be able to embalm.
Right. It's not going to be able to, it doesn't have anything to preserve anymore. It's already in the deterioration process.
It's not that we, It's that the body, the sometimes even before the body dies, it starts going through the decomposition process. So as soon as your cells start dying, the lysosomes and stuff in your cells and the bacteria start doing their thing. So there is something called antemortem decomposition.
Interesting.
So the minute you die, I mean, your cells start breaking themselves down. That's just the natural process. And we put the bodies under refrigeration this depends on body weight, how much water is in your body. People who come from the hospitals that are hooked up on IVs are the worst because most of the time they have edema. They have so much water in their body from the IVs forcing the fluids in them. We have to embalm them like quick. And even then we can't guarantee that swelling and stuff is going to go down. So we have to know that you're going to want embalming pretty much within a day or so of the person passing, because the longer we wait, the less likely they are going to preserve or look well. Because once those cells start breaking down, if we try to inject, they could just swell up. Yeah. Because what formaldehyde does is it creates a polypeptide linkage between the cells and proteins, firms them.
Yeah, yeah. Okay.
But after a certain point, it makes it really difficult. And if someone is at the point of where we call that they are truly in the stage of decomposition, embalming is not going to make them viewable or help them. It's at some point it is too far gone.
Yeah.
Embalming would actually just make it worse.
Sure.
So we've had where people have been found in their homes, especially during COVID.
Mm-hmm.
Where people are found and not found for days, sometimes weeks, and people want to view. And I said, I'm sorry. If there was something I could do, trust me, I am the person who will do everything I can to make somebody viewable. And if after I've done everything, they're not viewable, I will let you know. But there are some that I just can flat out tell you, no, I'm sorry. They are not viewable and I would not recommend that you see them. It's too traumatizing.
Yeah.
And I still have people who still want to see them regardless. I just have to make them sign a waiver that says they will not sue us for any mental trauma or PTSD or anything that viewing somebody caused because we recommended they didn't.
That's hard.
It is. It is hard. And that's really hard when somebody wants to view and they can't because of circumstances. That's really hard because it's my responsibility as an embalmer to try
whatever is possible.
But there are some times that it breaks my heart to say, I'm sorry, there's nothing I can do. Because trust me, I'm the type of person, I spent 20 hours on this one guy who fell off a building. And all the other embalmers are like, closed casket. 20 hours on him. First night, I spent 11 hours. Because once I start embalming and I have to do the restoration, I have to complete it. I can't stop and take a break and do it the next day.
Right.
I have to complete the reconstruction of the skull and the face and everything. And so it all sets. And then I go and do the reconstruction, fillers, wax, clay, whatever I need to do. And then cosmetics the day of. I spent a total of 20 hours on this guy. And he looked so good. My boss was kind of mad at me because I spent so many hours in the prep room and not in the office serving other families. So when I went into the chapel to meet the family, and my boss was with me, the dad, he had a bunch of stuff in his hands. I can't even remember what it was. Boss said, this is, Miss Postmortem, and she's the one who took care of your son. And the dad literally, whatever he had in his hands, I can't even remember what it was, he threw it on the floor. At first I was like, oh crap, he's angry. He wrapped his arms around me and said, thank you for giving me back my son. That has stayed with me ever since that day, because that right there is exactly why I do what I do and exactly why I spent 20 hours on him. I didn't even get but 2 hours sleep that night. I started on him and I didn't get out of there until like 2 o'clock in the morning. That is why I do what I do. That right there. That is the most important. That's more than a paycheck, more than anything, even recognition from my boss. That right there, the family. That's who I work for. The company I work for may sign my paychecks, but in essence, I work for every single family that walks in that door. That's who I work for. Emotionally, spiritually.
It's to have that effect.
That's what...
I know as an artist in other ways, I know that I feel like I have done my job when someone comes up to me and says, here's how this made me feel. That's sort of, to me, what art is for, is to evoke that humanity in whatever form it's going to take mm-hmm. with that person. But I know I've done my job when mm-hmm. I elicit that response to something I've done.
Exactly. It's not about, okay, well, they get to see the person, you know, that's, we did our job. No, you have to go beyond just the function and step into literally the spiritual.
Sure.
I mean, it really, at one point in my career, when I was pushed out of the prep room by another embalmer mm-hmm. and was not allowed to do what I do, it crushed me. I mean, it literally felt like someone had ripped part of my soul out to not be able to take care of the families that I was actually meeting with. I'm a hands-on person. I mean, I meet with that family and I see them through the entire process to the time that the casket goes in the ground or they take that urn home. I am with that family for yeah. the entire process. And for me to not be able to take care of their loved one personally and then have to try to either fix or explain why they look so bad. And, but not just not being in the prep room, being able to do what I was trained to do. It literally killed, it just about killed me. It killed part of me.
Yeah.
And luckily I have a former funeral home I worked for. Whenever they're embalmers on vacation, I don't live very far from them. They call me up and say, hey, can you do some embalmings? I'm like, yes, thank you.
Yeah.
And I'm in my element. I'm playing music. And believe it or not, I'm talking to them. I treat them like patients, like people. I talk to them and I listen to, you know, I listen to music. I say, okay, what kind of music would this person? Okay, this person looks like they'd like classic rock. Okay, let's put on some classic rock. Okay, let's put on some Celtic music for this one. I know this one's Irish.
They're wearing a tartan and they've got...
Not being able to do that really, really hurt me. I mean, it yeah. really, really killed me.
I have a couple of other funny questions. Are there tropes that you want to dispel in terms of myths around...
Oh, goodness. besides the hair and fingernail thing?
Yeah.
Okay, dead bodies do not get erections.
Okay.
Okay, let's just... I know some of you are all thinking it, so let's just put that to rest right now. Even if someone passes away with an erection due to either, believe it or not, heart attacks can cause erections mm-hmm. because of the blood flow, strangulation, hanging, violent death. It is not a permanent thing. The penis is not a bone. It is not going to stiffen up and stay that way. So please stop thinking that everybody has a Woody when they die and we put them in their casket or something. Okay. It's just not.
Just, okay.
Not true.
What are some other?
Embalmers are not necrophiliacs. Okay. Stop it with that. Don't fetishize or romanticize about the dead, okay? That's ew. Not just unmorally, ethically, but scientifically and microbiology. Ew. Stop it. And as a matter of fact, most of the people who are caught in the act of lewd acts with a body usually are not even necessarily in the funeral industry or morticians or embalmers or things like that. Oftentimes, they just conveniently have access.
Right.
Or there's actually two types of necrophiliac. Within the act of killing somebody or, you know,
assaulting
someone, they die in the process and they keep going or then engage in the act of is actually the most common form of necrophiliac. It's quite horrifying, but that's the most common. But as far as everybody saying, oh, you guys, you know, you mess around. No, we don't mess around with the bodies. Trust me. Mm. No. And the things that I have seen downstairs on people, it's like, why would anybody want to even... Don't go there, people.
Is mortuary and funerary art something that you are drawn to when you're looking at other kinds of art? Is it something that intrigues you elsewhere?
Oh, heck yeah. Oh, yeah. I'm goth. And goth isn't just like white face paint and black lipstick and listening to The Cure. Ugh. It's a way you perceive where you find beauty. So... Something like...
In the ephemera is sort of my first answer.
Yeah, somebody might see a skull or something and be like, look how beautiful this is. I mean, this was a person. You see beauty where other people see darkness or taboo or morbidness. I mean, it's like you see art in a different way. You see art in things that most people are like, that's just creepy.
Yeah.
We're like, no, that's beautiful. What are you talking about? And if you saw my house, I've got like red painted walls and I've got like skulls on the mantle. You know, I've got the statue of the goddess in the Morrigan. know, goddess of war and death and strife and all that other stuff. And so, yeah, just a little bit does it affect, you know, do I see it everywhere?
But where can people find your art? Where can people sort of start to get an understanding of what it is you do? Maybe those are two different questions.
Well, see, it is actually illegal for me as a mortician, a funeral director, embalmer to take pictures of my work. Mm-hmm. Even if I am extremely proud of it, sure. I am not allowed to take pictures. I would literally have to get the written permission from the family. Mm-hmm. And morally and ethically, I would never ask a family who is grieving. Because if I'm doing restoration, obviously it's an unexpected, tragic, or violent death.
Right.
I would never ask them, could I take a picture of the work I did, for my portfolio? No. And that's one of the things that the show Six Feet Under,
right,
made people think was a common thing, that all of us morticians have these binders of all of our work. Oh, look at this one I did. Look at this one. Oh, this one had a crushed head and I fixed that. Here, look at my work. No, we do not do that. That is actually illegal.
Also, it's just rude.
It's just rude. It would be, it's unethical.
Yeah.
It's invasion of privacy. Especially if you had, like, before and after pictures. But the family can take pictures.
Okay. I will tell you, as someone who has performed at memorials and funerals as a singer, I come across people who say, well, do you have a portfolio of your funerary songs or your performances in this context? And I'm like, no, these are people I love. These are families. This is someone I've known for decades. And they asked me to sing about this person's life. Like, of course I'm not going to have recordings of stuff I've done for other people's funerals.
Especially keening, because isn't it kind of just like... in the moment, storytelling kind of the person?
It's a whole different practice. We can kind of get into that just briefly here. Keening is an Irish, a very old Irish practice, and it's not done much in modern day, but it's a way for a community to gather and to speak and sing and continue the stories about this person and how they touched lives. And so some of it's, in fact, a significant amount of it is extemporaneous, and it's a place in which people spend a lot of time acknowledging this person's life and impact on them as a community.
It's a lost art.
I'm glad it's not entirely lost. Let's put it that way. But it is super hard to find examples of for exactly this reason, right? Mm-hmm. You never the idea of photographing or filming this process is just disrespectful.
In times of COVID, actually, filming has become a lot more prevalent. Mm. We've had Zoom funerals, Zoom graveside services.
Okay.
We've had people set up cameras to record it so that they can send it to their families who couldn't be there. Recording is becoming a lot more prevalent, especially with the cost of travel.
Sure.
Too. So I think that's another thing we're going to see shifting in years to come, is that we're going to see more people maybe even hiring professional
videographers
to come and do videotape services. I'm seeing it a lot more, especially with COVID. And unfortunately, so many chapels and funeral homes are not equipped to provide that service. And I'd like to see that change, to have the option of having a Zoom funeral, having something that's already set up in the chapel to allow people who can't be there to attend live, you know?
Yeah. My cousin's wedding she married an Indian man, and Indian weddings are huge and beautiful traditionally, right?
Oh, I love saris.
And she's super happy, and they're super cute couple. And they basically, I got to see it through video. Like, I got to see the film montage of this gorgeous, elaborate series of ceremonies and stuff. But they're hoping, because they're both physicians, they're hoping that people can gather in the spring, vaccinated and stuff, but fingers crossed, we'll see.
And that's something also that's shifting in the funerals, especially in times of COVID, which sounds like in times of cholera. Times of COVID, the families are doing a private, especially if it's a burial, they're doing like a private graveside service where they do the religious ceremony, doing the burial with just like the family there. And then later, when things open up a little bit more, they're planning a celebration of life. And even before COVID, I was seeing a lot of that. Where the families are starting, especially with the younger generations, they're starting to decide, instead of making this a solemn, mournful occasion, let's do our ceremony and lay the person to rest or whatever. And then we want a celebration of life. Yeah. We want party. We want stories and we want laughter and we want photographs of memories. We want to celebrate this person. You're starting to see that shift, which is really, really nice because people are trying to go back to going to making it about the person and remembering the person, remembering the good times. Because isn't that what we all want when we die? We want people to remember the good about us and not focus on the fact that, you know, we died.
Not like the Joan Crawford version of...
The fact that we died, you know, the fact that died or us dying is just a small, tiny little blip in our life. It's like the period to this long sentence before we die. And so let's remember everything before. Or that there's a poem called The Dash. I don't know if you've ever heard that.
I don't think I have.
It's a poem about a person is born and a person's died. You see this on their headstone. But what's most important is that dash in between the date. That little dash is an entirety of someone's life. You want to remember that part about somebody. And that's what more people are doing celebrations of life, because they don't want it to be solemn. And the other thing is they want to give time to plan it. They want to get time to get through their grief so that they can take the time to plan a proper send-off or proper memorial.
Can people ask you questions? Can people reach out to you?
Oh, yes.
How do they contact you or connect or support you? Hey, I'm trying to do this thing or learn this new skill or this funky thing. Like, I don't know.
Okay.
How do people support any of your art?
Well, actually, I've had a lot of people, I've had people reach out to me that are interested in the business, and I don't mind answering questions at all. To me, there's no such thing as a morbid, stupid, or ignorant question. All questions are valid, unless it's about necrophilia. Not valid, sorry. You don't ask that question. But if they have questions, the way to reach me would be Facebook is Miss Postmortem. I'm on Miss Postmortem on Facebook and Instagram, or MissPostmortem@gmail.com.
And then I have one final question, and it is my personal funny question.
Okay.
And that is, if you were a Muppet or a series of Muppets, what kind of Muppet would you be?
Are you talking like a...
Could be a combo of Muppets. Doesn't have to be full on the Muppet.
I'd be a Skeksis. I would totally be a Skeksis. I mean, those things creep me the hell out sometimes, but in essence, it's like, they dress really well. You know, sometimes they have those really elaborate, like, collar pieces and stuff like that. And they're kind of creepy, but they're also kind of cool. So I think I would totally be a Skeksis.
Oh my god, that's great. I think you're the second person to come up with an answer from the Dark Crystal.
Oh, with somebody, whatever the other one's called. The I know Skeksis, but
yeah, was Dark Crystal. Yeah. You're right. Oh, right.
Little Pomeranian thing that opens his mouth really wide.
Right.
Gelflings. Gelflings. That's the other.
No, Gelflings are the little ones. They're the main character.
Oh, those are the ones.
The ancient little, ones. The old ones. The what are those called? The
oh gosh.
Do you know what I'm talking about? It's the opposite of the Skeksis.
Yeah.
No, the other person that mentioned the Dark Crystal as inspiration, you know, place to draw from about, like, who are you, right, was Agra.
Oh, okay.
She was like, I'd be a cross between Mr. Toad from Mr. Toad's Wild Ride with the, like, the swirlies over the eyes when he's stealing the car and Agra. And I was like, oh my god, that's a really great combination.
Either that or I'd be the Goblin King. I mean, come on.
How do you not love David Bowie in tights?
Not love David Bowie. Period. I mean,
fair. Thank you for joining on.
You're welcome.
Mixed Media Talks. Is there anything else that you want to say to someone or would want to sort of leave people with?
Never be afraid to ask questions. I mean, you, as somebody says, well, you never know if you don't ask. I mean, don't be afraid to ask questions. And most of the time, if somebody's passionate about something that they do, they're more than happy to answer questions and educate, no matter how silly or morbid or whatever you might think the question is. If somebody is truly, you know, into what they do, they're more than happy to inform. Just make sure that, you know, that it's necessarily an appropriate question. Like I said, I have had people ask me the big taboo. It is a big taboo.
Yeah.
The N-word. that's the only place where I draw the line is like, don't ask me questions about that. Because you're not interested. You're just messing with me.
Right.
Yeah. You just want to be disrespectful. But you never be afraid to ask questions. I mean, Even we as artists are constantly learning. We are not necessarily complete experts in our field. We're always picking up things and learning things and adapting. And I mean, that's one of the beautiful things about being an artist. It's like, it's a never ending journey.
Yeah.
It's like always. My grandmother was 72 years old and she was still learning new art forms.
So final question.
Okay.
Final Jeopardy. Dun, dun, dun.
Yes, do you have any questions for me? I'd like to wager 5,000.
Do you have any questions for me?
I would say probably by knowing me and what I do, do you think that maybe I've maybe kind of changed your perspective on what it is that we do, given your bad experience with the chaplain and such?
I would hope that any future embalmer or mortician I come across in the future, or funeral director, would be anything like you in terms of the reverence and care that you put into the work that you do. Yes. That's what I would wish for someone like you in more of people doing that work in the world. Because I think that's really vital and important for people to be able to acknowledge and face their relationship with the end of life.
Yeah. And if I may, one just kind of last final statement, something that I've noticed since the beginning of me attending mortuary college, that so many people see us in a negative light. And some of that has to do with TV and Hollywood.
Sure.
And some of it has to do with us, people not understanding what it is that we do. I've been called a vulture, or I've been called a scammer, or a thief. All sorts of horrible things, especially since the pandemic. But to know that we're not ghouls. I mean, even as goth, you know, ooh, ghoul. No, we're not ghouls. We're not taking advantage of people during their hardest times. We're not someone to be afraid of. We're not bad people.
Yeah.
And we, you know, just do something that
needs doing.
Needs doing, and that 99% of the population wouldn't touch with a 10-foot pole. But it, one of the things that it is hard about being a mortician is that you do get shunned a lot.
Hmm.
And that people don't want to be around you. Or, I mean, even have, like, families who, if they see me in public, they'll turn around and walk the other way. Because I'm unfortunately kind of a...
You're a symbol.
Sometimes a bad reminder. Not that they lost someone. It's seeing me as, you know, dredge up. But we're not bad people. We're not ghouls. We're not vultures.
Yeah.
Which I find insulting to vultures, because they're actually quite intelligent, sociable, friendly creatures.
And so, valuable to and ecosystems, valuable, yeah. By the way.
But, you know, we're not bad people.
Yeah.
And I don't like being judged for what I do, because I love what I do. And I think it's important, but unfortunately, sometimes it can be very lonely being a mortician. Luckily, being a goth mortician, I have other fellow gothlings that think what I do is pretty cool.
Sure.
And other embalmer, other mortician friends, but it does kind of sting,
right?
That
that isolation and that necessarily,
that we're sometimes stigmatized as being bad or negative, and we're not. We're actually quite, excuse the expression, we're actually quite lively, bubbly, fun people to be around.
Sure, sure.
You know, we're not lurch.
No. You rang. Like, I love that. He's so funny. Thank you for joining the conversation and for going into deep places and hard places. I think this stuff is an important part of acknowledging all of the different ways our culture relates to art and elements of it that don't often get spoken about.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
And there's so many different death cultures throughout the world that there's no right or wrong way to do it.
Right.
And even though we may think one cult death culture is like really weird, like the people who dress up, dig up their loved ones and redress them. And I can't remember, I think I want to say if it's in Peru, But, you know, some people might say, oh my God, that's horrible. That no,
every culture has
their death culture. And frankly, they're all fascinating and beautiful and wonderful. And, you know, as a funeral director, because I deal with so many cultures, I can't be closed-minded about, you know, someone's practices.
Right.
You know, because they're all meaningful. Mm. And I think more people should also not only look at funeral practice, but just the world in general with that open-mindedness that there's so many different facets to culture and life and living and being. As long as we're a good person and doing anything immoral or illegal or evil or bad or that harm people, harm none, then let people, you know,
have their
culture. You know, I mean, there are limits, of course, but you know, it's all beautiful. Yeah. You may not agree with it, but it doesn't mean that there's not beauty in art there.
Yeah.
You know, I don't like modern art too much, but it doesn't mean it's not art.
Right. It's funny. There have been a series of conversations around that very topic. My hope for this episode is that I can get you in for Halloween or October-y.
Yes.
Because, like,
my favorite time of year.
I mean, yeah. Like,
I love October. Christmas I could care less about, really.
Sure.
Except for me, the part where I give gifts to people. I love giving gifts, as you well know.
thank you. But like...
Interesting. Okay, so outtake. So, I'm Irish heritage.
Sure.
And there's these, you know, the symbol of the triple raven. And ravens are messengers. And also in some beliefs, they carry the souls of the dead to the afterlife. So I've noticed that when I'm out doing a funeral service, that right when we either do the committal prayer or closing prayer or we're lowering the casket, all of a sudden the crows will fly over the gravesite and start calling out. And I just think to myself, I kind of look up and I think to myself, there they go. I'm kind of like, bye, Mr. Smith.
Right.
Bye, Mrs. Richardson. See you again. And it happens so often with me. And none of my other coworkers have anything like that happen, but it's like,
oh, thanks.
It's like, it's my friends. They're coming to help me. Of course, there was that one time that there were vultures circling this one gravesite. And we don't get vultures in my area very often.
Sure.
And it happened to be a decomposition case, and it was a wood casket, which doesn't seal, so we did our best to, so that you couldn't smell anything, but apparently they could, and they were circling the gravesite, and I was like, oh God, please don't let the family see this, please don't let the family see this, please don't let the family see this, and one of the son looks up and starts cracking up, busting out laughing, points at the vultures, and like, ah, look! And then I was just thinking, please don't land, please don't land, please don't land. Luckily, they did not land. But, yeah. I am so glad the family thought that was hilarious because I was, like, trying not to laugh myself because it was like, this is just wrong.
I mean, it's earthy, right? It's part of the cycle.
When people see vultures, they'd be so offended. But it's just, they're doing what they do.
Yeah, like this is part of the role they play.
They have a really good sense of smell.
Yeah.
They do what they do. God, I love those things.
Thank you, Miss Postmortem. This has been Mixed Media Talks. You can find and support our program by going to patreon.com/mixedmedia_talks. Thank you. Go.
So, you know, there's a one funeral art that I... The couple funeral arts that I really wish they would bring back, but mainly Memento Mori.
Yeah.
So, you know, like the lockets of hair and things like that. We have something similar these days, like fingerprint jewelry. But the one thing I miss is...
life gems.
Oh, God, those things don't even get me started on those things. Those things are overpriced and overrated.
They're hysterical, though. You could become the family jewels. Like,
family jewels. I thought that meant something else.
Well.
But funeral photography. Well, Memento Mori photography.
Yeah.
I would love to see something like that come back. I mean, I have done some Memento Mori photographs for people who couldn't be there to see their loved one.
Mm-hmm.
And I've, you know, I did a little bit artistic, filtering and stuff with it to make it look softer or, but I would love to see that, see something like that come back. I mean, a lot of the Asian culture, especially like Filipino, they take pictures of their loved one. They take pictures with the casket, with their grandma. Ah, it's grandma, selfie, dead grandma. But it's totally cultural. It's cultural. It's totally fine, even though some people cringe. But I would love to see some Memento Mori photography still done.
Yeah.
I've seen some really beautiful ones. There's an artist that does, portraits of people's, hands.
Yeah.
And they're really, really moving. And beautiful. And I've actually done a couple of the hand portraits for families. But I think that would be a really beautiful art form to, I would love to see a come back.
Yeah.
And I've actually thought about getting a camera and offering something like that. But I know the company I work for may not be keen on that.
Right.
But,
well, and you'd have to get the special permission.
Well, yeah. I mean, it would be something that the family would hire me for. Because, you know, in hospitals, they have something called, they have the people when a baby is stillborn or that they have a photographer that, you know, that takes like pictures of their little feet or take pictures of their hand or because it's like it's literally a memento mori because that's the only picture that that family is going to have of their baby, you know. So it is a little bit in practice, but I think it could be, you know, just as meaningful and as beautiful as it was back in the Victorian era.
Yeah.
I think it'd be a really cool thing to kind of bring, maybe not mainstream, but occasionally have somebody who wants something like that. But not make it, not do anything. I know there's some people out there who'd be like, yeah, let's prop Grandpa up in a armchair with a pipe.
Weekend
of
Bernie's kind of moment.
Weekend of Bernie's, of course, you know. Yeah, the only reason why I would not be all for that is because it's not as easy as...
as you might imagine.
You might imagine. Okay. But that's a type of funeral art that I wish would come back. And the Memento Mori jewelry, too. Mm. We do something similar with ashes and glass and fingerprints. But, you know, remember how they used to do the locks of hair and the hair was woven into, like, little flowers and things like that? I always thought those were really beautiful.
I think there's something lovely about the expression of ephemera and the fact that things end and bodies do decay and lives eventually end. They just do. Oh, you were mentioning something about American funerary practices sort of stemming out of a cultural expectation to be afraid of death.
Yes, they say America is the biggest death-denying society in the world, and it is true. It is true. America really doesn't have a death culture. Almost every other country has a death culture. They have some sort of ceremony or tradition or something that they do that revolves around death and dying and celebration of that person's life. But in America and in other parts of some other parts of the Anglo-Saxon Europe, there's no, it's like lack of culture. It's almost, it's become a taboo. Like death has become a taboo subject. And it all stems from Puritans. And them preaching hellfire, brimstone, punishment, consequences, that people became afraid of dying because they were afraid they were going to be horribly punished when they died.
Right.
So, and therefore, it's out of, you know, they didn't talk about it because...
Because they're just hoping that it's in anybody's hands and maybe you'll be a good enough person in life to warrant... Yeah. A not fearful afterlife.
Exactly. So this, you know, the lack of death culture in America had a lot to do with this fear that was instilled in people about dying, where a lot of other cultures, they have, yes, every culture has death consequences. Like if you're, you know, you've done this, you know, there may be a consequence after death, but not to the degree where people don't even talk about it. I mean, I don't know how many families I meet with where it's like, oh, no, we never talked about what dad or mom wanted. Oh, no, we never talk about that. I mean,
yeah,
it's just become such a taboo thing in America.
It's funny because, you know, when, you know, I'm telling my story about being at this particular sitting in the hospital with the chaplain, who was kind of awful.
Oh, chaplain creepy.
Yeah. Chaplain creepy, yeah. And my dad had not that long before that offhandedly mentioned something kind of sweet about the place we were reminding him of the home he grew up in and the geographical region with all of its tree lines and the shape of the mountains being very similar and feeling like home. And that he wanted his ashes scattered there, so, which is the only way that I knew that he wanted to be cremated. Like it was just like on a bus ride. We're looking out the window going, yeah, this is really lovely. We should, that's very nice. Hey, if something happens, that's the thing. But we had never, like I had never assumed my parent was going to die because he was going to outlive all of us.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Yeah. Like that was, that we were all convinced. But as an overculture, we never did sit down. And we never did figure out how to sort through possessions or have a plan to sort through possessions among mm-hmm. six kids. And yeah. Like,
well, and how often in your family did you talk about like other relatives, even ones that you hadn't met that passed on? You know, how often did they talk about, oh, when grandma died or when grandpa died? I mean, it's like people, it's like once it's like it's done, out of sight, out of mind. Or people know they're going to die, but they don't even want to think about it. They don't even want to talk about it. It's become so taboo. And the thing is, it's so important to, especially with your children or your family or whomever is going to be, you know, taking care of you when you pass on. It's so important to let your wishes be known.
Hmm.
And even just putting it down in like your advanced healthcare directive or even making a unpaid pre-arrangement or something and letting your family know, hey, I have my idea, my wishes done here. People don't realize how important it is until it happens. And then they're like, I don't know what to do. I mean, it takes so much stress off your family if they knew what you wanted.
Right.
And if you had the funds to be able to prepay it, that's even less stress on them.
Like I was making, what was yeah. I making? I was like $10 an hour at a retail bank.
Yeah, so.
And like I had no way to know that I wouldn't even be able to have anything other than a cardboard box for my dad. Like yeah. It was just, oh, the youngest kid. Like I just had no framework. But if I hadn't known about cremation, I would have not known anywhere to even start.
Yeah, and you know what? That is so common. It's you know, and I see the stress that it puts on families.
Yeah.
And not only emotionally, but often financially, and just trying to them worrying about, did I make the right decision?
Mm.
Is this what so-and-so wanted? I mean, most of my family didn't even talk about it until I became a mortician. And then it was like, they kind of, I kind of not force them to talk about it, but I did kind of like nudge, you know, hey.
Instigate the conversation.
Hey, Grandma, what do you want?
Yeah.
I don't want to burn up. Don't burn me. I'm not going to burn you, Grandma. Yes, you will. You're going to burn me. I know it. It's like, oh, just go to the funeral home, make pre-arrangements. Do what you want. But yeah, it's, I don't know. I just, that's why I like these death cafes that yeah. they sometimes have where people can just go and sit and talk about it. And there will be, sometimes there's morticians there or hospice nurses and stuff like that. And it's just openly talking about it. Because really, death shouldn't fear death. And the one thing, unless, you know, of course, obviously dying in a horrible accident or, you know, unexpectedly.
Something traumatic and painful. But
I mean, just natural death, it's, so important to so many people fight it at the end. But those who have not and who have accepted, okay, you know what, this is what's going to happen. The transition for them and their family has been so much easier and so much peaceful. Mm-hmm. And that instead of that moment being turned into like, you know, fighting tragedy, ugly death, is that we, you know, it's because, you know, it was peaceful and beautiful and actually healing because they feel like, okay, no, they went peacefully. It was at peace. We feel okay about it. They were able to resolve some of their grief before the death actually occurred. It's called, oh gosh, can't think of it.
Like, I want to say grieving or
it's
something?
It's like ante-mortem grieving or something, you know? It's right. When people do their, go through part of the grief process before the death occurs, like when somebody's diagnosed with cancer, you know they're going to, you know, pass, and you actually start the grief process before that. So when the death does happen, you feel more peace and relief that the person's no longer in pain rather right. than, you know, you're just...
Like, you're, they've faced and acknowledged this part of...
Uh-huh. And you, in turn, and you face it together. But obviously, not everybody passes away like that. And sometimes it's unexpected and sudden.
Mm-hmm.
And... But if we talked about it more and just kind of accepted, eventually this is going to happen. And... we can be okay with it. There's a healthy way to.
Yeah. Like a friend of mine.
To approach it.
I love this phrase that they say. They say, it's all information. And information is something you can work with.
Mm-hmm.
When you're afraid of a big decision, an ethical choice, any huge challenge where you just don't know. What do you know?
Mm-hmm.
What is the thing that you can, like, is this going to happen? Maybe. Is the other thing going to happen? Maybe. If you don't know which one, those are the two choices, mm-hmm. or those are the two places you can look for how to proceed. I think that's a valuable way to consider, how do you approach mm-hmm. what if?
Yeah. And that's what my survival mechanism throughout my entire life is pretty much... prepare for the worst, hope for the best. If you kind of go through all the different scenarios ahead of time, say, okay, if this happens, this happens, you have your momentary freak out ahead of time.
Sure.
And then when it does happen, you're mostly prepared for it. And it's not as hard. You're like, okay, I know how to handle this. I mean, yes, you're still going to be devastated. You're still going to hurt that your loved one passed away. But it can be... you can take those last moments and instead of focusing on like, oh my gosh, you can't go, you know, and fighting it, make those moments, last moments count.
Hmm.
You know?
There's songs about...
talk to them, tell them you love them, you know, ask them about their childhood, ask them about stories that, you know, you don't know.
Yeah, well, and like I was just saying, or about to say, I was going to say, there are songs about... particularly buy me flowers while I'm still here.
Mm-hmm.
Right? Acknowledge those moments of the stories that you can catch while someone is around to be able to share them with you. And I think one of the hard things about families that do have a lot of challenges and issues and backstory and pain and trauma involved mm-hmm. in their own stories is how do people approach their grieving differently
mm-hmm.
and how do they resolve when their grieving doesn't look like someone else's expectation of their grieving.
And that's the thing. I know I love, is it Kubler-Ross? She wrote the Grief, Death, and Dying books. It makes it seem like grief is like, you know, 5-step or whatever, 7-step program. And it's not linear at all. It's not you go through this, 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 and this. It is, you're a ping pong ball and you're bouncing all over the room. I mean, one minute you could be telling a story and you're remembering a story, you're laughing, and the next minute you're crying because, you know, a butterfly, you know, flew by the window and you know, you thought of them, or you're angry because you never got to resolve this one argument you had with them, or you're angry because you feel like they left you. There's all these different feelings, and it's not linear. You don't go through, you know, it's not a 12-step program. Okay.
Right. Well, and even
it's, you know, it's a roller coaster, and you can make, I just want to tell people to make the, especially if you know the person's sick and they are going to go, make those last moments, days, weeks, whatever, make them count.
Hmm.
I mean,
I like it. Are there tools in particular you're like, oh,
there's lots of books. Oh my goodness, there's so many books and reading and articles and stuff about, you know, grief, death, and dying. And
do you have any favorites that actually seem like they're pretty helpful?
You know, I can't think of one right off the top of my head.
Or any books about the funerary process of embalming that are actually valuable for people to read up on?
Well, the problem is that those are all textbooks. So sure. Very clinical. However, actually another person, I absolutely love her as, Ask a Mortician on Yahoo.com. YouTube. She has all these videos. Ask a Mortician. She's a mortician in Los Angeles. She also has three books. When Smoke Gets in Your Eyes, From Here to Eternity, and the one that I haven't read yet, but I have it at home, Will My Cat Eat My Eyeballs?
Will the cat eat your eyeballs?
Actually, they're more likely to eat your face, your nose, your fingertips, anything soft is what they're going to go for first. Now, crows and ravens, however, any kind of bird like that, they're definitely going for the eyeballs first. They always go for the eyeballs first. So if you have a parrot, beware.
Question. Halloween traditions and death.
Yes. So one thing I do is I set a table setting with the favorite foods of the people I want to visit me. And it's usually my grandmother on my father's side. Mm-hmm. And my mother usually sets a space for her sister and her brother and her sister, her two sisters. And then also we put a, we don't put a real candle because we don't want to burn our house down. So we have an electric candle that we put in the front window,
I did that, by the way, once when I was about 18. I stuck one in the windowsill and I lit the blinds on fire. And by the way, the house was a Victorian. It was from the 1890s.
Oh, shit.
Yeah, it was not good. And I woke up from a nap with the maintenance guy who happened to be on the property working on another apartment. And he was like, didn't you hear the smoke alarms? Like, didn't you? And I was like, oh, whoops. And of course, you know, I'm 18 and this is my first apartment. Whoops.
La, la, la. Yeah, so I do not recommend putting the live flame in your window. So you could easily find the electric candle tapers, but you put that in the window and that lets your ancestors, people know that at the time that you're welcoming them into your home.
I like to call them beloved dead.
Beloved dead. Dearly beloved.
Yeah.
Deathly beloved.
Because, like, for me, I've come across a lot of conversations with people who have various histories and experiences with family who don't accept their queerness or their creativity or their lifestyle as or profession in other ways or whatever.
Yeah,
and so
lifestyles.
They don't have necessarily good relationships with ancestors or all ancestors, but the ones they do, they're the people that have mattered to them and have touched their lives.
Yeah.
And they are beloved.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, okay.
Yeah. And I have had visits from my grandmother. She actually visits quite often, especially when I'm having a hard time.
How do ghosts show up for you?
It's usually Well, when I've worked in the mortuary, I've had some encounters, and those were interesting. And some of them, I believe, were the people that I were actually physically working on at the moment. but it's mostly, sometimes I've heard things, but, with my family, if my grandmother's visiting me, I know she's there. I can feel it. I can sense her. I can actually not hear her audibly,
right,
but hear her here. And so it's kind of a feeling. Plus my cats start meerkatting. They'll do the whole meerkat thing where they stand up on their hind legs.
Like, someone's in the room, hello.
Yeah. Or they'll all, like, start chittering towards the, you know, and their little tails will shake because they're happy.
Yeah.
They do a little happy tail shake. So it's like, oh, grandma's here.
It's so funny that there is such a taboo about death and dying and the idea of ghosts as this, you can measure it, it's not universally experienceable, and all this. And I always kind of bristle at folks who decry the weird stuff that is just a part of human experience, mm-hmm. that includes the dead sort of tickling the back of your head or tapping you on the shoulder or letting you know that they're in there. And it feels like, oh, am I crazy pants? Am I wearing tinfoil on my head?
Oh, no, I had one straight up smack me across the back of the head while I was embalming. I was like, excuse me, you do not do that. Because there was nobody else in the building. It was just me. And it called, wham, right across the back of my head. How rude.
Yeah.
And then I've had where I love Lorena McKennitt, so I often play her while I'm embalming. And I was working on this one lady one time, and it was Dante's Prayer. The song was Dante's Prayer. And at the end, and you had that slow bit of that violin fading out, I all of a sudden heard this woman weeping, like sobbing. And I was working on this lady, and I just looked down at her. I said, it's okay, honey. It's okay. You're not lost. We're having your funeral tomorrow. You're going to be going with Jesus. Cause she was a Southern Baptist. I said, you're going to be going with Jesus, honey, tomorrow, and your family's all going to be here, and you're going to look so pretty, and everything's going to be okay. You know, and it's like I said, I talked to him. And then, there's been times I've come to the prep room, and I was just like, nope, 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 not going to be in here today alone. Mm-mm, nope. Bye. Cause I just had a bad feeling about somebody, and then I found out that person really was a bad person, like really bad person. Oof. Like I was like, oh, that was right. But it's mostly a feeling, but occasionally like you hear things like I don't know. Well, I was walking through the funeral home at night one time, and every time I would walk, I'd hear several footsteps behind me. Like even after I'd stop, it'd be like, so it wasn't an echo, and it was like, okay, stop following me.
It's so funny, though, like, this sort of thing is so common the world over that ghost stories exist in every single culture, yes. Right? And I, you know, I've had people be like, well, it's not scientifically proven. And yet, there are, you know, people used to say that about electricity, too. And people used to say that about computer technology and AI and. So I kind of feel like, and physics development and dark matter and black holes and all of these things where we just didn't understand the tools to measure it accurately yet, which doesn't mean it doesn't exist. It just means we don't have understanding of it yet.
Yeah. And also I think that's kind of the allure and mystery of ghost stories and stuff. You know, it's like, it's unknown. That's what makes it so interesting and fascinating and sometimes terrifying. Mm. I mean, how can you explain that my mother and I lived in this house? I lived in the house my mother grew up in. And that house was about 180 years old when I lived in it. It was like the oldest house and second oldest house in our hometown.
Sure.
And recently, my mother and I had never talked about this before. And recently, a few weeks ago, my mother and I were talking about the old farmhouse. And I said, the old staircase, because it was a cedar staircase, narrow hallway, went straight up, and then he made a right turn and he went to the bedrooms. I said, I was terrified of that staircase. I would run as fast as I could up to the top of the staircase and turn around, and I would not look up because I felt like there was a man standing over the landing with his hands on the railing, looking down over the staircase, and he was angry, older man, angry, like you were in big trouble. And my mom went, oh my God. When I was a kid, that's the way I felt going up that staircase. I always felt like there was a man and he was like, I was going to be punished. I was in trouble. I was in serious trouble and I had to run up those stairs as fast as I could and not look up because the landing was up there, not look up in fear that I would see this man like staring down at me and he was going to, you know, get me. I mean, this is like, you know, 50 years apart. I mean, I was little, my mom was little, and we're talking about this all these years later.
Hang on.
I mean, how can you explain that we had the same feeling, the same image? I mean, we even described the man.
Hang on. Okay. Clearly, we've been at this for a while.
Yeah.
I love these conversations, though.
I mean, but how can you explain that?
So what I think I'm going to do is, yeah, I think you can explain it by the stuff that we don't have measuring tools for yet.
Yeah. And I really actually hope we don't have measuring tools for those ever, because I think that takes away the mystery and allure and everything about it. Hmm. You know, I wouldn't want it to be explained. Because I think also sometimes the ghost stories and all of that, it kind of gives us comfort that there is
unknowing.
There is something after this and that our loved ones or beloveds can possibly visit us. That there is something after this. If we discover it and explain it away, we lose kind of some of that comfort.
And some of the beauty of the life that is here while we're having it, while we are occupying physical shapes, right? Corporeal.
Yeah, I mean, I hope I can, like, you know, come back and visit. Of course, if I were to turn into anything after I die, I definitely would want to be a forest witch or like a banshee or something. You know, keep people out of the natural wildlife reserves by, you know, scaring the crap out of them. You know, oh, the loggers are coming to cut down trees. Get out of my forest. I don't know. But I hope we never truly explain it and discover it, because I think I think the mystery is what it kind of gives hope.
Yeah. Is maybe what matters.
And also, come on. I mean, before we had television and stuff like that, we had stories. We had oral history. We had not fairy tales necessarily, but we had stories and things like that. That was
how we shaped our lives.
Yeah, and that's how
explained what our relationships to, you know, each other looked like.
Yeah, and I think it's something. I think it's beautiful, and yeah, it's terrifying too. But our life has to have some mystery. We can't. Shouldn't explain everything away, you know, with science. There's some things that just need to be left to the heart and the imagination. Yeah.
Thank you, Miss Postmortem. This has been Mixed Media Talks. You can find and support our program by going to patreon.com/mixedmedia_talks.